From NPR and WBUR Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, and lots going on in the presidential campaign today, where Donald Trump's criticism of the Muslim parents of a slain U.S. soldier continues to reverberate. This morning, for the first time, a Republican member of Congress, Richard Hanna of New York, wrote in an op-ed that it's not enough to denounce Trump for saying that Khazir and Ghazala Khan shouldn't have spoken out last week. Hanna now says he will vote for Hillary Clinton. And President Obama called Trump unfit to be president, saying this to Republican lawmakers who continue to back Trump.
This isn't a situation where you have an episodic gaffe. This is daily and weekly where they are distancing themselves from statements he's making. There has to be a point at which you say, this is not somebody I can support for president of the United States.
Joining us now is Scott Detrow, who covers politics for NPR. Scott, first of all, what do you make of what President Obama said? There are Republican lawmakers listening when he says that. And do you think that this fight with the Khan family and Donald Trump has become a turning point in the campaign?
Well, first to Obama, I think what's interesting there, it's a continuation of the argument that President Obama, that Hillary Clinton, that so many other speakers made at the Democratic convention last week. They were clearly reaching out to moderate Republicans, to traditional Republicans who may be squeamish about Donald Trump, saying, you may not like what the Democratic Party does all the time. You may not be on our side, but this is a candidate who does not fit your party, does not fit the traditional mold of presidential candidates. And you should think about voting for us because Donald Trump has a different view of America than you or I are used to. That was the argument they made over and over and over again. And I don't think the Democrats could have scripted anything better than what played out over the course of the weekend in the way that Donald Trump went after the Khan family, pushed back against the Khan family and questioned their religion, and also compared sacrifices that he said he's made in his business career to the ultimate sacrifice of a soldier dying for the United States on the battlefield.
And what about the idea of this being a turning point? Does it sound like that's what this is in the campaign, that this is going to change the direction?
You know, I think we need to hear from more voters. I think we need to see more polls. We're waiting for polls to come in from the convention itself. But I will say, just in the way that this has been covered and in the way that high-profile Republicans are rushing to distance themselves from Donald Trump to, you know, that statement that John McCain put out yesterday, it was like a 700-word statement saying that Donald Trump was wrong on this.
Yeah.
This feels to me like it could be a moment like when Trump went after that federal judge, Gonzalo Curiel, a couple months ago for saying that he was not able to arbitrate fairly the Trump University lawsuit because of his Mexican
right.
heritage. That's something that clearly stuck with voters. That's something that clearly stuck in the narrative. And I think this could be a moment that's as powerful as that.
Well, let's listen to what the Trump campaign is saying. Today at a rally in Virginia, Trump said a veteran handed him his Purple Heart and told him to, quote, keep saying what you're saying. And Trump said this about Republicans who don't like him.
Listen, even if people don't like me, they have to vote for me. They have no choice. Even if you don't, and you do like me, I hope. But I said, even if you can't stand Donald Trump, you think Donald Trump is the worst, you're going to vote for me. You know why? Justices of the Supreme Court.
And meanwhile, at a Mike Pence town hall event in Nevada last night, Trump supporters booed a woman who identified herself as the mother of an Air Force soldier who said Trump disrespects military families. Here's that exchange.
Well, I thank you for the question. It's all right. It's all right.
Don't politicize the military.
Folks, that's what freedom looks like and that's what freedom sounds like. Okay?
He's saying that's what freedom looks like and that's what freedom sounds like. He went on to praise the Khan family. But what do you make of the response from the Trump campaign?
Well, going back to that first point, what Donald Trump was saying about the Supreme Court, and even if you don't like me, you should vote for me. I mean, that's the counter argument to this outreach from Obama and other Democrats saying Republicans should vote for Hillary Clinton. You know, Donald Trump's campaign put out a list of possible Supreme Court picks. They were all very traditional, mainstream conservative choices, you know, federal judges with strong conservative voting records. And that's the argument they're making to Republican voters, that you don't want Hillary Hillary Clinton, who many Republicans have distrusted and despised for decades in the White House, and you don't want another Democratic president making these Democratic choices that could linger for a long time. So that's what not only the Trump campaign, but a lot of high-level Republican surrogates fall back on. I mean, that's what Paul Ryan says, even though he criticizes Trump for so many things. He says, look, in the end, this is a Republican president who Republican lawmakers could work with to get Republican things done.
They're also going after Hillary Clinton and saying she voted in favor of the Iraq war. And so if the cons should be mad at somebody, they should be mad at her. Of course, Donald Trump also was at the time in favor and has since changed his position. And his vice presidential pick is also somebody who was in favor of the Iraq war.
That's right. I mean, the Iraq war vote was a fatal vote for Hillary Clinton in the 2008 primary against Barack Obama. Not sure that sticks as much these days. It's just been a long time. And you're right. So many principles are on the same page there.
Lots to watch in the campaign. It's really heating up. And we're not even at Labor Day yet. Scott Detrow, who covers politics for NPR. Thank you.
Thank you.
To Syria now, and reports of toxic chemicals being dropped on a town in Idlib province, not far from where a Russian transport helicopter was shot down by rebels recently. The group Syria Civil Defense tells Reuters they suspect the barrel bombs contained chlorine gas. Clashes continue today in and around the city of Aleppo, where rebels have launched an offensive to try to break a Syrian government siege. It appears the Syrian government's months-long effort to recapture the parts of Aleppo long held by rebels is reaching something of a breaking point. The United Nations says up to 300,000 people remain in the eastern section of Syria's largest city. The BBC's Syria correspondent Rami Ruhayem joins us now from Lebanon. Rami, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
What can you tell us, what do you know about the situation on the ground in Aleppo today?
In humanitarian terms, the situation has been bad for a long time. The rebel-held parts of the city are under bombardment from time to time. It escalates at times. It decreases in intensity at others. But in general, the humanitarian situation has always been bad, even prior to this offensive. Now, this clearly is a concerted attempt by the regime and its allies, the Shia militias, backed by Russian air power, to encircle Aleppo. This is something they have done to several parts of Syria, which were counted as rebel strongholds, which the regime decided need to be taken back for its own security, to protect their situation in Damascus. So if they do this to Aleppo, it would probably be a much bigger thing, because Aleppo is a much larger city than Homs, for example, and it's also a very strategic city, very close to the Turkish border. Aleppo, in a way, embodies all of the international regional struggles that are going on in the region, and the final encirclement of Aleppo would be a big blow to the opposition. But, as we have seen, the rebels quickly launched a counteroffensive, and we have yet to see where that's going.
And the population in the eastern parts, they're essentially trapped there, Rami, low on food, water, and medicine, correct?
Yes, again, a dynamic we have seen in several parts. Perhaps not yet as bad as, for example, what we saw earlier this year in Madaya, closer to the Lebanese border, where we heard about starvation in certain extreme cases and very bad nutrition situation for all of the people stuck there. We haven't seen that yet in Aleppo, but we know that it's a very difficult situation, especially for the civilians trapped there.
Rami, we've seen on social media that children are burning tires to try to thwart Russian and government aircraft from flying easily over Aleppo. Is that having any effect at all from what you know?
Well, it's hard to measure the effect of something like that in military terms. I guess that's a question for experts and pilots. But there was a sense that it gave them a mental, psychological push, because basically there it was, that very strong image of children burning tires, and it was framed by opposition activists on the internet as their own no-fly zone. That is, of course, very far from what a no-fly zone would look like. Even if it did have a small effect, it certainly didn't have the effect of a fly zone. But you can see this need for renewed hope at the moment of a very difficult military and humanitarian situation they are in, and a military siege.
The poor man's no-fly zone. There are also reports that humanitarian corridors have been opened up to allow some civilians to escape these rebel-held parts of Aleppo. But others are skeptical, and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry warned recently that the humanitarian aid plan could be a ruse. What do we know about that?
Well, we know, first of all, that we don't know anywhere near enough to be confident about what's going on. But the humanitarian angle has often been used in deceptive ways in Syria by the regime. We have seen several times when the humanitarian situation came to a point where there was some sort of pressure for relief, and that didn't really happen except as a facade. We can't say this is what's happening now, because we're so far away and we don't know what's going on. But all the reports of certain, or many of the reports about corridors were contested very quickly by activists on the ground.
The BBC's Syria correspondent, Rami Ruhayem, joined us from Beirut. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now. I'm Eric Westervelt. On Friday in Rio, the opening ceremony kicks off the 2016 Summer Games. And all week, we're talking with former Olympians about their lives during and after the Games. Today, Frank Shorter. In 1972, he towed the starting line for the Olympic marathon in Munich, West Germany.
Today, he is the fastest man in the marathon field. No one has run 10,000 meters as fast as Frank Shorter. He was the top-rated marathoner in the world last year. He is a heavy favorite.
Shorter lived up to the billing. He won the race. But his triumph followed tragedy, the killing of Israeli athletes by Palestinian terrorists in an event that stunned the world. Jim McKay of ABC Sports captured some of the shock.
They have now said that there were 11 hostages. Two were killed in their rooms yesterday morning. Nine were killed at the airport tonight. They're all gone.
4 years later in Montreal, Frank Shorter finished second in the Olympic marathon, losing to an East German runner who was eventually linked to that country's systemic doping program. But his athletic achievements are just part of his life story. He and his siblings survived a monstrously abusive father whose outbursts of physical and sexual violence scarred the entire family. Frank Shorter's new book is My Marathon, Reflections on a Gold Medal Life. He joins us from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Frank Shorter, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you, Eric. It's great to be back.
I have to start with your father and the abuse you and your 10 siblings suffered, because as you write in the book, the abuse in some ways fueled your running life and how you lived your life. Your dad, Dr. Samuel Shorter, to the outside world was this selfless, kindly family doctor in upstate New York. But the reality at home, behind closed doors, was very different. Tell us about his dual life.
Well, it was. He was a totally different person. When he came home, his main purpose at home was to discipline his children and then also to stifle any creativity or goals or anything else about them. My conclusion really is he's one of those few human beings who didn't want his children to exceed him. I realized at five when he was beating me up one day, he would come home and interrogate my mother late at night. And then his modus operandi was then decide which child he was going to discipline. And we would wait for, and we'd hear him come up the stairs, and we'd just have to see into whose room he would go and who he would drag out of bed and beat. And I found that at about age eight, I began to spend a lot of time out of the house, and I started to run. And then I realized that this was really stress relief for me, because when I was out there, out of the house, running, he couldn't get me. He couldn't catch me. That really is how I got into the running, to minimize stress and cope rather than to have goals of going to the Olympics.
You found out almost by accident that, you know, to escape your dad's control and physical and in some cases sexual abuse, running was the perfect outlet.
It was, because it was something he didn't do. He wasn't an athletic person. And so I think it was part of my first way to not be like my father. And now as an adult to look back and realize, I think I had this instinct of not passing this along. And I tell all young kids when they start in sports, I say, try all sports, because there is a biomechanical movement that every person loves and enjoys the most. Mm. And mine happened to be running. I found I just loved moving across the ground. Mm. I could think about whatever I wanted, and I was safe.
Skipping ahead to 1972 and the Munich Olympics, which really was a turning point. We heard that TV clip from 72. You were right across the courtyard from where the Israeli athletes were staying when the Black September terrorists attacked. You heard some of the first shots. Did you know right away this was an attack? Take us back there.
I was sleeping on the balcony. It was like 4 in the morning, and I said, I've been out here for several days. It's the first time I've heard this. This is not a door slamming. This is a gun. And as we went through the day, we just stood out there on the balcony and looked across. And at one point, if people can remember, there's a famous photograph of one of the terrorists in a balaclava with a submachine gun on the balcony. Well, we saw that person. And that shows you how naive we were. It had never happened before. And all he had to do was just sort of spray bullets at us if he wanted to, because we were that close. But we were, in a sense, all in shock.
Frank, after the attack, the games were paused for a few days, and you and your teammates debated going home, not competing. But you ended up staying, of course. And then, you know, the morning of race day, you laced up and ran the marathon of your life. How could you put out of your mind this horrific attack, and how did you process it in order to win?
Well, I think the modern term is compartmentalized. And I think I learned at a very young age, when I went outside the door of my house, which was a prison, I could just turn off thoughts and focus on things over which I had control. So that's what I would do. In effect, blot it out and then think about it when it was appropriate, because the only thing over which I had control was fear, and fear of what the terrorists might do. And I was just not going to let them win on that.
Frank, you had running. Your 10 siblings may not have had that kind of powerful outlet. How have they responded to your writing of this book? Has it helped them at all?
I think it's helped them more than me, because I'd say, I won't go into exact people, but I think only about half of my siblings really emerged into adulthood well. And when it came time to corroborate the initial magazine story that was published in Runner's World in 2011, they said, well, and by the way, the story came out, I just brought up the subject in a story, you know, an interview on, okay, what's he doing now? And then the editor at Runner's World, a fellow named David Willey, basically said, hold the phone here. And they sent John Brandt, who became the collaborator on you know, this most recent effort, sent him back, and we talked about what had gone on. And they needed to corroborate the story because my father had died. And they said, well, we want to talk to your sisters. And my initial reaction was, no way. You're not going to do that. Because, you know, I wasn't going to bring, I would never, ever want them to think that I was doing something at their expense and doing something for myself that required them to revisit something that they didn't want to. And so one of my sisters fortunately acted as an intermediary. And even with sisters that she doesn't get along with, that shows you the dysfunction. It just continues. And they opened up, and the story just became even more horrific. I mean, there were rapes. There were it was horrific abuse. And it was good, better for them, I think. And when my brother died last year, which was sort of the impetus to maybe finally write the whole story and how it fit in the context of my life, you know, how I think about things, how I do things, and where it came from, they were much, much, not happier, but they were more relieved, I think, to finally have it out there, because part of this process is, number one, you really, really have the kind of fear of this kind of person that you can't describe, and it lasts your whole life. You fear this person in a way that is indescribable.
Your family was traumatized
gripped by fear. And then, you know, the other part of it being that by their being able, you know, to talk about it, it actually is true. And I think part of that is you wonder, since it was so horrific, and I know my sisters did too, am I making this up? You know, have I imagined it as worse than it was? And we all found out, no, it was worse than we thought it was.
Right.
And so it really was good for them, because now there's no sort of undercurrent anymore when we get together. I think that's the best way to describe it.
Switching gears back to the Olympic movement in Montreal 4 years after the 72 gold medal. You lost to an East German who was later connected to systemic doping, performance-enhancing drugs. Here we are in 2016. The Russians have been banned, the track and field team, because of doping. I mean, why should the public be optimistic at all that they can clean up track and field, let alone any other sport?
Because a model exists, and it's United States Anti-Doping, which has no conflict of interest. And right from the start, when I was involved in the beginning and was chairman of the board for 3 years, our saying was, you can't promote and police. You have to be totally independent. And that was the structure of U.S. Anti-Doping. It's a model. And World Anti-Doping, really along the same lines. So all you would have to do would be take away drug testing from all the international federations and have Thomas Bach, who's the head of the IOC, say to all these federations, if you don't do this and create an independent drug testing agency with no conflict of interest, in other words, no promoting and policing together, you can't be in the Olympic Games. And guess what? We're going to audit your program frequently enough that you're really going to have to show that you're truly independent and transparent. And this independent agency has control over all aspects of doping, you know, the testing, the adjudication, the appeals, education, everything. And that model is USADA. And Thomas Bach could do that tomorrow.
Gold medalist Frank Shorter, his new book is My Marathon, Reflections on a Gold Medal Life. Frank, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
McDonald's says it will no longer use high fructose corn syrup in its buns. The fast food giant announced this week that it will instead move to sugar as part of a larger mission to simplify ingredients and appeal to more health-conscious consumers. The company also announced it will start rolling out new chicken nuggets and other items without preservatives, and it says it's curbed the use of chickens raised with antibiotics, commonly used on humans, a year ahead of schedule. Here to talk about this is Jason Bellini of the Wall Street Journal. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
So why is McDonald's making all of these changes?
Big changes, as you just described. And Mike Andres, he's the president of McDonald's U.S. operations. He's calling these sweeping changes as they're going to affect 50% of the menu. As far as why they're doing it, he says that it's because diners themselves have been asking the company to do away with ingredients, in particular high fructose corn syrup. And that's because some research suggests that it may cause weight gain and diabetes. But this is really part of a larger effort on McDonald's part to simplify its ingredients. And you know, you got the more conscientious consumers these days who have more choices out there.
Well, and I wonder how much of an impact on health McDonald's expects there would be by switching from high fructose corn syrup to sugar.
Well, you know, they're not, you know, making any pronouncements about health. They're not saying that you're going to get skinnier on a Big Mac with the new buns. Well, I mean, this is part of, you know, it's sort of an image campaign. You know, like they've been running these new ads that show their breakfast items made with freshly cracked eggs, and you know that they've announced plans to stop using eggs from chickens raised in cages. Whether those eggs are more healthy because they're not from chickens raised in cages, hard to say. But you know, again, conscientious consumer, and you know they're doing also things like, you know, serving some of their milk from and yogurt from cows not treated with artificial growth hormone, and getting that message out to consumers, hey, we're making these changes because that's what people want.
And McDonald's is not the only one doing things like this. We've talked about some efforts by Walmart in the past, but other companies also addressing these concerns from consumers.
Well, exactly, yeah. And McDonald's rivals have actually been quicker to embrace the so-called clean label movement. You've got General Mills, Yum Brands, which owns Taco Bell. They've been stripping their products of ingredients that have been making consumers wary. You also have Heinz and Pepsi offering more products that have removed the high fructose corn syrup from their products. So it's not just McDonald's, and they're, you might say, struggling to keep up.
Is the high fructose corn syrup industry talking about how they feel about this?
Oh, well, yeah, as you can imagine, they're not particularly thrilled. The Corn Refiners Association, that's who represents the makers of corn syrup, and they say that these switches have happened before, but the nutritional value of both high fructose corn syrup and sugar, they say, is essentially the same, and says many companies that have switched over to sugar and then later reversed that decision. And that's because they say sugar and high fructose corn syrup each have their own advantages.
That's Jason Bellini with The Wall Street Journal talking with us about McDonald's latest changes, including removing high fructose corn syrup from its buns and curbing the use of preservatives in some products. Jason, thank you.
Earlier this month, HBO premiered a miniseries called The Night Of. We've got a clip of the trailer.
Explain to me what I'm not understanding.
It looks like I killed her, I know that.
That's how it looks.
The critically acclaimed show centers on the murder of a young woman in New York. But to some, the storyline raises some uncomfortable questions for HBO. Joining us now is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hey, Eric.
Hi.
You're in California for the TV Critics Association gathering, and over the weekend, your colleague, NPR's Linda Holmes, asked a senior HBO official why so many of the network shows seem to include sexualized violence against women. Tell us about that exchange.
Yeah, so HBO in the past has received some criticism for particularly the show Game of Thrones and how in its early seasons it had a lot of scenes that seemed to be kind of gratuitous showing rape and sexualized violence against women. And now HBO has some newer shows. There's the show The Night Of that features a beautiful woman who is murdered in the first episode, and also a new show called Westworld that's about an amusement park staffed by androids in which humans can go there and live out their fantasies. And there's a scene where a human dressed as a cowboy drags off one of these robots, and it's implied that he rapes her. And so Linda wanted to raise the question of, you know, is HBO still using this kind of sexualized violence against women as crucial plot points in a way that could be disturbing and could be considered unfair? And he didn't exactly answer the question.
Yeah, we got a cut of tape here of Mr. Casey Bloys with HBO in an exchange with TV critic Melanie McFarland, who, along with yourself and others, pressed the point after she asked about this.
I don't necessarily think that it's specifically or isolated to women.
So what you're saying is that eventually we're going to see the same kind of violence, specifically rape?
We're going to kill everybody.
Eric, you made a joke out of something pretty serious. I mean, how'd that go over in the room?
Yeah, you know, what was problematic about this? So Linda raised the question, and he sort of said, you know, they have violence that's committed against anybody. And then Melanie wanted to talk about, well, you know, we're not just talking about violence, we're talking about rape. And then he tried to joke about it. And then I spoke up because I wanted to try and talk about the difference between sexualized violence against women and violence against everybody, because it seemed like the executive wasn't understanding or wasn't addressing, at least, how it can be unfair when this violence is shown in one way against women rather than others. And I think we've got a tape of me trying to talk to him about that.
Violence directed against women is different than dismembering somebody or beating them up.
Yeah.
Rape against women is this particular kind of violence that's about oppressing women.
Right.
And there are many critics who are concerned that these shows seem to normalize that.
Eric, what was his response?
Finally, he said that was a valid criticism. But it took three critics asking him about it. And in an odd way, you know, two women asked him about it and he didn't really address it. But when a man spoke up and then he finally addressed the question, It made it look as if HBO was tone deaf to these situations. And so in a way, the exchange was very important. But in another way, it was a little discouraging to see this kind of reaction, you know, at a point in time when there's already been a lot of discussion about how HBO depicts violence against women.
So normalizing it and using it as a go-to plot point that in some ways glorifies it.
Exactly. And I think the idea is that I'm not saying as a critic that there can never be a time when showing a sexual assault might be important to a story, but you have to be careful about it. And I think that's the discussion that Linda tried to start and that Melanie and I tried to continue. And hopefully HBO's gotten the message a bit.
Eric, do you think HBO is changing at all in its depiction of rape and sexualized violence?
Well, I'd say what concerns me is what I'm seeing is that they're depicting less. They're implying this violence in a way. What happened on Game of Thrones, for example, is that they were criticized for some pretty explicit depictions of this kind of violence. You know, the actresses were naked and you could see a lot. So when they depicted a scene where a key character got sexually assaulted last year, they didn't show it very much, but you could kind of hear it. And in this Westworld pilot that I'm talking about, critics have seen it in advance. The show will debut later this year. We don't see the assault again. We hear it, and it's implied that it's happening. And that's a step in the right direction in that, you know, you're not sort of bombarded by these images. But the whole point is to get them to rethink the scene itself.
NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
So here's a question. If you use public transit, when your train station closes for repairs, do you change your commuting habits permanently? Jacob Fenston of Here and Now contributor WAMU has our story.
It's the end of the workday, and Robin Kotchin is waiting for her train home. But unlike almost every other day in her 30 years working in the nation's capital, she's not in a subway station waiting for Metro. She's at Union Station waiting for a big diesel locomotive. When service on her Metro line was reduced in June, Kotchin had to find a new way to get to work.
My first thought was, oh, well, I'll drive. But I thought everybody's going to jump in their cars, so I can't do that, but I can get a bus. But then again, everybody's driving. That bus is going to be stuck in traffic.
Then someone suggested Virginia Railway Express, something she'd never tried. And she loves the ride above ground. Now she says she's not going back to the subway.
I was actually not looking forward for the first surge to end because I thought, I don't want to go back to Metro. Then I was thinking, well, why should I?
So you feel like it's sort of you formed a new habit now.
Absolutely. New habit. And I'm sure others have too.
Others have. Since Metro launched its Safe Track maintenance program, officials have been urging riders to stay off the trains with huge signs reading, "Rethink your commute."
When you change the environment like this and disrupt a habit, you sort of give people a window of opportunity to be making new decisions about how they get to work.
That's Wendy Wood. She's a psychology professor at the University of Southern California. She studies how people form habits and why they're so difficult to break.
The experience, once you've formed a habit, is that it's just easier to keep doing what you're doing than to make a decision to do something else.
Wood says once you form a habit, you probably won't look for a different way of doing things unless you're forced to.
So as far as other options, before the whole SafeTrack thing came out, I just didn't know that other options existed.
When Jim Nuno had to look for an alternative way to get to work, he found one right next door. His neighbor had been driving the exact same commute that he'd been using the subway for. Now they drive together and take the carpool lanes.
It's half the time. It literally takes 30 minutes now, door to door, instead of 60. So it's kind of brilliant.
Ridership on Washington's subway system is down as much as 80% at some of the affected stations. But getting riders to return may not be all that difficult. Pam Murray Tewitt is a transportation engineer with Virginia Tech who studies transit disruptions. She says research shows people are reluctant to change how they get around. If they have to, they'll make small adjustments, like leaving earlier. But
mode tends to be the least popular type of change.
It's hard to get drivers out of their cars and hard to get transit riders out of the trains, in part because decisions about travel are often baked into bigger lifestyle choices that have already been made, where you live, where you work, where your kids go to school. So Murray Tewitt says the vast majority of Metro riders will probably return after SafeTrack.
Because it was the best for them to start with. And once conditions go back to being normal, in many cases, that will still be the best option for them.
But some people, she admits, will find new, better options that stick. Like riding a bike. Cycling has been up as much as 90% in some areas, and DC's bike share program set an all-time record during the first week of SafeTrack.
What's your favorite part of the ride?
Oh gosh, I love going by the tidal basin.
This is Shoshana Griffith riding her bike on her way home from work downtown.
When the sun's setting, you get the light on the tidal basin, it's really pretty.
Griffith used to ride one way and take Metro the other. Now she bikes both ways. It takes a little longer, but now it's what she's used to.
Well, it's just like if your commute involves going up a hill on your way home. You get used to those hills right away.
So even though the 16 miles round trip is exhausting, Griffith says she'll keep biking even when the subway system is back to normal. For Here and Now, I'm Jacob Fenston in Washington.
And a question to our listeners, especially those living in New York City, where the L train is about to undergo some repairs. What are you going to do? Are you going to change your commute permanently? Let us know at hereandnow.org. Today, we're kicking off our weekly election series with a district profile of Colorado's 6th Congressional District. Incumbent Republican Mike Kaufman is facing a challenge from Democratic State Senator Morgan Carroll. And here to tell us more is Megan Verlee, reporter with Colorado Public Radio. She's in Denver. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, let's talk about this district. First of all, it's kind of a half moon shape to the east of Denver. Tell us a little bit about it because it has changed recently.
It did change a lot with the last round of redistricting. It curves through the eastern suburbs of Denver from a sort of old line industrial lower income area in the north down to a much wealthier, more suburban area to the south. Up in the north, you have big immigrant and refugee populations. So a lot of Latinos, a lot of folks from Africa and South Asia. And then when you get down to the southern end, it's much more white and Asian. So it's probably the most diverse district in the state and definitely the most politically divided.
And it includes Aurora, which, of course, has been unfortunately in the national headlines for, of course, the movie theater shooting there.
Exactly. So, you know, a place that's experienced extreme violence. And I'm sure we're going to see guns and gun control become an issue in this race because the Democratic challenger helped push through gun control regulations at the state level right after the Aurora shooting, or about a year after the Aurora shooting. And on the other side, Mike Kaufman, you know, military veteran, is pretty pro Second Amendment. So that will probably become an issue in this race.
Well, let's listen to one of the ads. This is a district, as you said there, Mike Kaufman has been representing since 2009. Here's an ad from him where we hear from a number of people from a range of backgrounds talking about the congressman.
Mike's not like other politicians. He's not like other Republicans. I think he's better. No one works harder than Mike. Nobody works harder than Mike.
Nobody works harder than Mike.
Mike's one of us.
He's one of us.
Mike Kaufman is uno de nosotros. Mike is one of us.
Mike is one of us. And we heard there the Spanish, Mike Kaufman is uno de nosotros. Tell us about this ad and what you take away from it.
Well, I think it just perfectly encapsulates Kaufman's challenge this year, which is that he's running in a very diverse district when the top of his party's ticket, Donald Trump, has really staked out a position against illegal immigration, has really offended a lot of folks in the Latino community, and has also been very concerned about the refugee program. This is a district that has a lot of refugees, some of whom may have become citizens and can vote. So Kaufman has been working very hard to distance himself from Trump. He has not said he would vote for him. He hasn't said he would never vote for him. But for him, he needs to convince his voters that a vote for him is not also necessarily a vote for Donald Trump.
I'm assuming based on that, that Kaufman was not with Trump when Trump came to Colorado the other day.
No, in fact, he actually issued a critical statement the day before Trump's visit. There were dueling critical statements, both from Morgan Carroll and Mike Kaufman. Carroll trying to connect Kaufman and Trump, and Kaufman trying to distance himself and bringing up some of his concerns.
Well, let's hear about State Senator Morgan Carroll. Here's a video on her website.
People actually deserve a Congress that's going to work and a Congress that's going to work for them. And frankly, they deserve to expect and receive real results on real issues that are going to affect their daily lives.
Tell us more about Morgan Carroll.
Well, until she made this run for Congress, she was the Senate Minority Leader, and before then, the Senate Majority Leader, before they lost their majority, actually, kind of in the backlash from the gun control session that she helped run. She's been a pretty influential member of the state Senate for a while now. She was perhaps not accidentally on the redistricting committee that drew the maps that put Kaufman from a very safe Republican district into a very competitive district. So It's going to be a pretty interesting matchup between the two. They both have long legislative histories that each other can point to an attack. One other element, which I haven't mentioned here, is that Kaufman is a veteran, and this is a district that has a fairly large retired military presence. There's a very large over-budget, behind-schedule VA hospital being built in the district that has become sort of a major scandal, and Kaufman has been very active in that issue. So he is also really trying to run on his championing of veterans' causes, his fight against the VA. And that is one area where Morgan Carroll does not have a military background. And so, you know, I'm sure he'll be trying to draw some distinctions there.
What do the polls say?
I have not seen specific polling for this district. 2 years ago, we actually expected a fairly tight race. Kaufman had another very hardworking challenger with a decently high political profile. And Kaufman took him out by, I think, 9 points. Hmm. So people are expecting a much tighter race this time. Democratic turnout, obviously, up for a presidential year, and especially because of the Hispanic population in this district and what's going on in the Republican Party around immigration policy. Everyone is expecting a much closer race for Kaufman, but I haven't seen any polling yet.
That's Megan Verlee, a reporter with Colorado Public Radio, talking with us about Colorado's 6th congressional district and the race going on there. Megan, thanks.
Thank you.
And again, we're going to be checking in with a different district each week as we continue to cover the House races around the country. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to Here and Now.